Welcome to Literally from the North Shore. Today we'll continue with a reading from The Ice Dancer, read to us by its author Connie Ellis of Duluth. The Ice Dancer takes place someplace north of Two Harbors up in Canada and includes wilderness lakes, saunas, and opera-loving sled dogs. Continuing now with The Ice Dancer.
Gabriel's earliest years. Exceptional abilities. Can that be done? Mrs. Darling asks Mrs. Dorr, the principal. They stand at the window of Mrs. Darling's first grade room, which overlooks the play yard. Gabriel has walked the length of the top middle rail of the swings and now stands on one end of the rail, hopping rhythmically from one foot to the other. He takes a quick little jump, seemingly without looking at the pole. It slides down to the ground. They watch as he runs around the outskirts of the playing field, doing front flips in the air, effortless back flips, and he ends his romp galloping back to the other children, where he slides in the dust to a quick stop in front of Susie, who throws up her arms in delight and giggles. The grandfather was in the circus, Mrs. Dorr says. An acrobat, I believe. Trapeze artist. Though she isn't sure about that. She heard it from Mr. Quinlan, who teaches sixth grade, and a lot of his comments end with, I'm pretty sure. Yes, must be so, must be so. Mrs. Darling doesn't know what to make of Gabriel. She thinks he's like a character from a book, of the type she doesn't understand. But then what can you expect, she tells herself, with parents like his. His mother picks him up early each day for lessons, but they've never said what kind of lessons. She knows from Gabriel's file that he speaks French, Italian, Spanish, and German, but she thinks his mother calls to him in Russian when she stops to pick him up. Even their car is odd, some combination of a Model T and Jaguar in black, like the mother's clothes. She always wears a peculiar hat with a broad front brim, and she laughs, even when it's below zero. Mrs. Darling infers from the car that the family may be involved in some type of general gangsterism. The father has a connection to music, but she doesn't know just what he does. Mrs. Darling thinks Gabriel's lessons may be Russian lessons, circus lessons, such as juggling, lessons of an unusual scientific nature, or violin lessons, and she hopes it's the latter. Gabriel is far beyond his age group and his schoolwork, even though he is out for weeks at a time. They no longer move students ahead grades like they used to, and when Gabriel returns from a trip to New York or London or Paris, he brings a postcard for each child in the class and asks Mrs. Dorr for permission to talk to the class about his travels. His fellow students genuinely like him. He's always fun and never acts like he's showing off. He spouts facts and figures, interesting anecdotes, and answers the children's questions as though he is a humanities professor, as well as a 7-year-old student. Chapter 6. Greta has an appointment with a psychiatrist for 3:30 this afternoon, and she's making her list. Dr. Winkle said she should bring a list of her favorite childhood horrors and suggests she have at least 3. Her confidence in Dr. Winkle is starting off poorly, but she has no choice as he is the only psychologist in this part of town. She found his name in a free paper at the Arts Cooperative. She makes a list. 1. Coal man. 2. Nuns. 3. Leeches. She adds, 4. Liver. 5. Her brother chasing her with slimy garbage from the sink drain after the dishes were washed. 6. Night crawlers on sidewalks after a rain. 7. Dresses with puffy sleeves. So what has any of this to do with seeing Gabriel in the snow, she wonders. Dr. Winkle's office is in a corner brick building on the second floor next to a dentist's office. She can hear the low buzzing of the dentist drill as she lies down on the couch. Dr. Winkle's long nose seems to be pointing at Greta, and she associates with the dental drill. He smells like old cigar butts and chewing gum, and his small eyes are hooded like a lizard, but he has a gentleness When he smiles, it helps her relax. She tries to ignore his badly bitten nails. "No, Gabriel was never my lover," she tells him, "though we were lovers when we danced." He cannot understand this. "Our spirits made love," she tells him, "while we danced." Dr. Winkle nods his head and says, "I see, I see." But she sees that he doesn't. Dr. Winkle wants to know if Gabriel and the coal man looked alike. Greta, normally a very patient person, has already decided to finish her hour, pay the doctor, and never come back. It was a mistake to come. But she tells him she doesn't really know what the coal man looked like. He was always covered with coal dust, so she couldn't tell. Gabriel is made of air, light, and now snow. The coal man would come to the back door and holler out, "Coal man," in a loud and serious voice. Then he would open the outer door of the coal chute to the coal bin, tilt the truck dumpster, affix the slide, and down would come the coal, a black avalanche of coal, crashing and banging its way into the empty coal bin, a wonderful and thrilling terror to Greta and her brother. There was always something exotic and secret about the coal. They take a break, and Greta gets up to stretch. She looks out the window while Dr. Winkle heats water for tea in a lopsided metal container with a door, which whistles like a train when the water is hot. Outside, it's still snowing, but not so heavily as yesterday. He sets both cups of raspberry leaf tea on a table by the couch and tells Greta he'll be back in a moment. He disappears through an inner office door at the side of his office, seemingly toward the dentist's office. Greta can see the shadows of two men and hear their conferring voices through the opaque greenish glass window of the dividing door. The tea is delicious. She is nearly finished when Dr. Winkle returns. He settles back with his tea and tells Greta she is afraid of men. She associates men with the coal man, and she is afraid of falling down the coal chute to hell, so can only make love when she is dancing, which is not love, but an illusion. He also tells her that he would like a stained glass hanging for his office window, and he'll look at her glasswork at the craft store before they close today. She can tell Dr. Winkle is in a good mood now, feeling it is no longer necessary for him to listen. He can just talk, which he prefers. He tells Greta to relax, asks if she wants more tea, which she doesn't. She settles back comfortably on the couch, and Dr. Winkle begins the story of his Aunt Ruth, his grandmother's sister, from whose garden has come the raspberry leaves for their tea. Ruth lives about 10 kilometers north of town on Wall Street. "Oh, it's just a dirt road, but we call it Wall Street," he says, "because she owns the property up and down both sides of the road. Good farmland. She is filthy rich. But you wouldn't know it to look at her. She wears dresses made of flour sacks, makes them herself on an old treadle sewing machine. Filthy rich." He nods at Greta and smiles. His teeth are tiny, but very white. He goes on to tell about Ruth's penny-pinching background. How she had to pay her brothers for a ride to town when she was a teenager. The family made their money in real estate, buying up farms when prices were low and times were hard for many, but they held on to the land and rented out the acreage they couldn't work themselves. Greta finds no connection between his Aunt Ruth and herself, since there is none, but still she listens. Her hour will be up in 10 minutes. She doesn't want to talk more to this peculiar man. She'll keep Gabriel to herself and get sleeping pills, even if Fawn says they're addicting and you don't have proper dreams when you take them. Ruth is in her late 70s and the only one left, he says, snapping one fingernail nub against another. After Dr. Winkle has walked Greta through Ruth's garden, row by row, past the peas and beans and cabbages, and straight into the strawberry patch with the biggest, sweetest berries in Canada, the session comes to an end. Greta puts on her coat and gets out her checkbook to pay Dr. Winkle, but he says, "No, no cost, no charge today." She doesn't like this at all. "I'll just write one," she says, and writes a check for $75. since she has no idea what an hour with a real psychologist would cost. But she wants to be fair, and she wants to get out. He refuses to take the check, so she leaves it on the table by the teacups. At the door, Dr. Winkle tells her to get some coal, put it in a little basket, and look at it. Think about it. Talk to it if she likes. And next time they'll talk about the coal and about her father. He gives her a new red toothbrush as she leaves. Chapter 7. Gabriel Dimitri Perez. From the reviews. Ballet will never be the same. There are times one looks for tricks in order to explain. A delicate, distant kind of airiness. An original quality of awareness all his own. Gabriel, the Archangel. Saturday night, an audience was transported to paradise. Unaware of an audience. The dancer's dancer. Women swooned in the aisles. Dances as if before gods. The greatest dancer since Nijinsky. I gave up on the review. Gabriel withdraws from the ballet scene. Impulsive decision. Unfounded rumors of failing health. Final performance. At present, Gabriel's studio is one large rectangular room with hardwood floors, high arched windows set in brick walls, one partially mirrored wall, and an end wall featuring a large round abstract stained glass window of deep blue and purple, forest green, velvety red, and pure winter white. A gold oriental screen with white cranes sits in a corner next to a grand piano. An alcove leads to a bathroom, and next to it is a small refrigerator-less kitchen with a wood-burning stove, a microwave, and a calendar of doors from around the world. A postcard of blue ice from Glenn Gould is tacked to the wall. The studio has no furniture, no bed, no chairs, and no phone. One Chagall. The music library is in a second alcove behind the piano. Gabriel looks among the S's of the CDs for Erwin Schulhoff, chooses his quartet number one to match the intensity of his mood. He selects his music intuitively and thinks of his music collection as his tarot cards and his friends. Every day now he dances. Before, he could do only exercises. He could teach his students, demonstrate a few measures, but could dance, really dance, maybe once a month. Yet every day to condition himself, he would dance within. He would sit in meditation in the center of his studio listening to the music. He could dance in his mind, and it gave him great joy, as well as a sorrow he could not put to words, in which he knew would bring on the pain. Today, he has his freedom back, and he dances all four movements, then bows down on one knee in silent tribute to Schulhoff. And coming out of the rapture of the dance and back into his own body, he begins to weep. He walks about the studio, brushing away salty, stinging tears, so thankful for the music, for the return of his body, and thankful to the ancient Chinese who were crazy enough to dream up acupuncture. Gabriel gathers up the little notes people are always slipping under his door because he has no phone in the studio. He has no tolerance for the ringing of phones or the hum of a refrigerator. The sound of any motor annoys him, with the exception of the motor of a boat. I don't think I should have to dance to Stravinsky. His music makes me too nervous. Please leave me a note after class. Don't talk to me about this. From Joy. I really need a private lesson. From Jennifer. Donna can't come to class tomorrow. She has bronchitis. When are you going to get email? From Donna's mother. There is also an invitation to a party at the Bazzetti's for Friday night. Why didn't they mail it? Because he has no phone, do they think he refuses to use the post service? And last, from his fishing pal. Come for duck dinner tonight at 6 o'clock. Dave drops the duck bones, one by one, onto the center of the plastic, blue checkered tablecloth and leans forward as far as his big belly will allow. He studies the bones. "I see changes," he says. "Coming for to carry me home," he sings in a deep, whispery voice. Dave and Gabriel are both now concentrating on the bones. "The duck is trying to tell us something," Dave says, narrowing his eyes as he leans in close to the meatless bones. He places both hands flat on the table, as if to hold it down while he holds his breath. His hiccup breaks the spell. Dave pours himself the last of the Beaujolais, sniffs it, and swivels it around in his glass. Gabriel pours himself another mineral water, squeezes in lemon juice along with a few seeds, and they clink glasses in a toast to the duck. "To the duck! To the duck! May his life not have been in vain," Gabriel says. "Damn cold that day we shot him," Dave says. "I didn't shoot him," Gabriel says. "That's right, you were shooting stars." Gabriel feels his face aflame, embarrassed all these months later, remembering how he shot at the first ducks they saw, even though they were a mile away. He didn't have a chance of hitting one, but he didn't know that. No one taught him how to hunt or how to fish. Dave just looked at him and later made a comment to a buddy about his long-range shooting, which of course had just scared off the ducks. They had gone down to the lake that morning in the dark with the stars still thick in the sky, dropping anchor at the edge of a thicket of reeds. The water was icy as they eased the dozen or so black wood decoys onto the lake, then sat waiting in the cold for dawn, listening to the oars creak in their sockets as the boat rocked gently up and down. Gabriel was horrified when they pulled in the ducks David shot. Two of the ducks were still alive and fluttering broken wings, and one tried to swim away, its head crooked, demented with pain. He had wanted to shoot Dave then and there, wring his neck, and toss him into the icy waters of White Deer Lake. Dave pushes his plate aside and leans back in his chair, picks up his tattered paperback copy of the Upanishads and reads, "The sage must distinguish between knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge is of things, acts, and relations. To become one with him is the only wisdom." "To become one with the duck," Dave says. "To become one with our enemies," Gabriel says. "To our enemies' enemies," Dave adds, finishing his wine. Again, they sit and contemplate the bones. "To fly without wings, that's what the bones are saying," Gabriel says with finality. Gabriel plays with the wishbone, running its greasy edge along his own clavicle, considering how a man might distinguish between knowledge and wisdom. How can an animal enjoy its animal self? And why was the mallard so delicious? "Come on, I want to show you something. Up on the roof," Dave says, looking at his watch. It's a few minutes before 1 a.m. Dave puts on his coat, ready to go. Gabriel sits at the table with his hands folded in front of him, while Dave waits patiently beside a tattered black and white poster of Bob Dylan in the stairwell. "Okay," Gabriel says, getting up abruptly. He slips on his sheepherder's jacket and follows Dave up the stairs. Dave opens a window at the landing and climbs out to the flat roof of the veranda. Joining him, Gabriel steps out next to a bowl of snow. Several bowls of snow are scattered about the flat rooftop, some on foot-high logs set on end, though most of the logs are topped with wooden cigar boxes filled with tall rectangles of snow. Next to the railing, a couple of ski poles are sticking out at odd angles. Big Dave sweeps the snow from the bowls and boxes with a tiny whisk broom to uncover frozen birdseed. His quick movements are precise. He's careful not to brush away the seed, the treasure of his snowy architectural dig. "You need some umbrellas up here, something," Gabriel tells him. "What do you do when we get several feet?" "Oh, it's not that deep. This side doesn't get hit too bad. Over here, though," Dave says, stepping over the bowls to the ski poles, "this is the new thing. They're lined up with the satellite." He stands looking at Gabriel, calculating the difference in their height, surprised at how close they are. David thought he was much taller than Gabriel. brushes the snow off an upended log and sits down, explaining how you look at the top of the left ski pole and use it as a sight line to the right ski pole, that it will line up with the northern star just off the lower right star of the bowl of the Big Dipper, marking the path of a satellite. "Should be here in just a minute," he says, gets up so Gabriel can have the astronomer's seat. Gabriel sits on the cold log and matches the ski pole to the marker star and waits. The stars are thick and bright in the dark Canadian sky, and the satellite is easy to spot well before it reaches the marker star. Dave pulls a notebook out of his inner jacket pocket and with considerable satisfaction and self-importance enters the time in his logbook. Gabriel is appropriately impressed with the accuracy of Dave's high-tech ski pole astronomy equipment and with his creativity. They watch the satellite cross the sky until it's out of sight, then look for constellations. Dave quizzes Gabriel on some of the major ones he's pointed out to him before, and they are both pleased when Gabriel finds the three stars of Orion's belt, Orion the Mighty Hunter, and the Bear. Then they climb back in through the window, well satisfied with themselves and the sky. Driving home, Gabriel thinks of how personal he takes the Canadian sky, especially at night. He almost thinks of it as a friend, and is sure Dave does too. He enjoys Dave. He is one of the few people who has no interest in dance or in Gabriel's past, and so he can enjoy this ordinary side of himself when they are together. Dave is a car mechanic with an unusual assortment of interests in a full-service garage just outside Winnipeg. They ended up friends when Tia, Dave's ex-wife, slid into Gabriel's car in a snowstorm, and they all spent the night at Dave's. She wasn't quite his ex-wife then, but close to it, going by the loud argument he overheard in the early morning before he got up. Tia manages a health food store near Winnipeg, makes her own carrot juice, grows her own organic vegetables, part of which she sells in the store. Gabriel has been a regular customer for 2 years now, though he's never told Dave. Tia doesn't eat meat. She couldn't even stand the idea, let alone the smell. When Dave would fry a batch of trout or venison hamburgers, she'd take off, and then open all the windows when she got back, even in winter. It was a doomed marriage. Simply a matter of dietary differences.
You've been listening to episode 3 of The Ice Dancer, written and read for us by Duluth author Connie Ellis. There will be 12 episodes in this book. Remember, you can always go to our website at ktwh.org, and under the Programs tab is Literally from the North Shore, where you'll find the previous 2 weeks' recordings if you want to go back and hear something again or you missed something. Most, if not all, of the music accompanying this book is performed by Connie's husband, Robert Ellis, on piano from his CD titled Moonrise. Today we'll close with two preludes by Gabriel Fauré.